a conversation with retiring astronaut Mike Fink, and a look at healthcare advances in space. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. After 30 years with NASA, astronaut Mike Fink is retiring.
Very blessed to have a chance to go fly in space, not just once, but four times.
We'll speak with Fink about his career, spending over 500 days in space on four different missions, and the medical issue that cut one of those missions short. Speaking of space health, what happens if somebody gets sick in space?
They have access basically 24/7 to Houston Mission Control, so anything that requires feedback from a specialist on Earth, they can just grab the phone and ask.
We'll speak with UCF's Dr. Manny Yerketa about the efforts to solve medical problems in space, from low Earth orbit to the moon and Mars. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Before we get into the show, an update on a previous topic we've covered. We've spoken about Catalyst Space's LINK mission on the show before. The spacecraft was designed to save NASA's Swift Observatory before it burns up in Earth's atmosphere by boosting its orbit. That mission started to have some technical issues, including control problems. Engineers on the ground tried to fix it. NASA and Catalyst Space now say LINK will not be able to complete its mission to boost Swift. The mission still plans to try and demonstrate how it would have boosted the observatory by rendezvousing with it, but NASA says Swift will likely enter Earth's atmosphere later this year without that needed boost. NASA astronaut Mike Fink flew on four missions during his career, spending 549 days in space and completing nine spacewalks. He's been on several different vehicles, including SpaceX's Crew Dragon capsule, NASA's Space Shuttle, and Russia's Soyuz capsule. On his last mission, he encountered a medical issue aboard the International Space Station that cut his mission short. Here to talk about his time as an astronaut and how space exploration has evolved over the decades is retiring NASA astronaut Mike Fink. Mike, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Thank you.
You are wearing your astronaut jacket there with all of your mission patches there. I was looking, you have what, 549 days in space? Is that what you hit?
Yes, it took me 30 years to get there, but I'm very blessed to have a chance to go fly in space, not just once, but four times on three different kinds of rockets, three different kinds of spacecraft. And of course, to be commander of our beautiful International Space Station.
So after those 549 days in space and three decades and all those cool patches you got, why'd you decide to hang it all up and call it quits?
That was a tough one. You know, that's all I ever wanted to be was an astronaut. And I had to go through that whole thing that most people go through when they're younger. What do I want to be when I grow up? It was always astronaut. Now that I've done that, what else? First off, I really believe that humans should be exploring space. I believed that when I was a kid, but now I have data and experience to share that. In order to explore space, we need a lot of people to help us. It's a big team sport. So I think we go out and inspire the next generation. So I'm going to go out to academia and I'll be a professor at MIT and to get some more fine engineers interested in helping us on our great mission. I'll also be working with a few companies like the Capital Factory, which gets startups going. I'll be working in the space sector mainly and defense too, but they'll also doing more companies, American companies in the game. And I think that's how I can make the difference. It gives me some more experience too, things I haven't done before, so it'll be fun.
Have you ever taught a college classroom before, Mike? Professor, I should say.
I've been a guest lecturer several times, so I think I got it. I think I got the shtick, and I think I had some interesting stories and interesting things to teach.
Boy, I would love to be taking that class with you. That sounds really fun. This may be a very difficult question for you to answer, Mike, but of those 549 days in space, is there anyone that was particularly exciting or your favorite?
I can just say that you can't pick your favorite kid. You can't pick your favorite roommate. But I will say some of the memories I do have. My first mission, I flew into space, and it was just two of us, Gennady Padalka and myself, or a Russian guy, an American guy, and we had a great 6 months together. No visitors. He quickly left with the previous crew was Andre Kalpers from Netherlands, and I got to see space for the first time the same time he did, and that was a special thing to share. All my missions were fantastic. We're flying again on the Soyuz. Shuttle's finally coming up and spending time with shuttle, my friends, shuttle crews, my classmates, spending time on STS-134 with Mark Kelly and my crewmates flying the American mission, setting up the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. And then finally, this last mission, we had a really great crew.
The Soyuz is that's an interesting vehicle to fly up in, right? You're cramped, you're tight. The way that it lands is pretty wild as well. What advice have you given to some of your astronaut colleagues that are, because we're still flying Soyuz missions with Roscosmos? What advice do you give them for that kind of wild ride that you go on?
A lot of guys we send from the astronaut office to fly on Soyuz. It's their first mission. Fortunately for me, Soyuz was developed in the 1960s by Soviet Union, and I have the same physiotype as a Soviet male from the 1960s, short and squat. Studied Russian in college and spent early space station days helping get space station built in Russia. So I could speak Russian, so they let me be co-pilot. It was a joy to fly Soyuz. Some of the other guys, we got two Russians in the seat, so they get to fly in the third seat. They're kind of along for the ride, but as myself and a lot of other folks just tell them, hey, look, pay attention. You're a valuable crew member. Keep your situational awareness, and you could be helpful. And sure enough, all of the Americans that fly end up flying on Soyuz, the Russians just nodded their head and said, that'll do.
Yeah. And you don't push the buttons with your fingers, right? You got a stick because you're so far back, right? Do you have a stick to push those buttons?
Well, the center seat, the commander needs the stick. My seat, the left seat, did not need the stick. And then we also moved from I was there when it used to be all analog controls. And then we had the digital age with the Soyuz TMA. And that happened in the early 2000s. So I got to see the Soyuz TMA as it came into being birthed. And that's one thing that I've been really lucky. I've seen a lot of new spacecraft. I've seen a lot of old spacecraft. It's really neat to see how things have kept evolving. And I'm excited about the future with Orion and Artemis and even more beyond that.
I had only asked because I wondered if you got to keep the stick, but that would have been cool, right?
Well, I am the worst souvenir guy. I don't, thanks.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Mike Fink. He is a retiring NASA astronaut after spending three decades with the agency. Mike, I want to talk a bit about the future that you were alluding to back then. You flew on STS-134, the second to last space shuttle mission. I had a chance to speak with Chris Ferguson, who was the commander of the last space shuttle mission pretty recently. And one of the things that was on his mind was that there are less and less people who flew shuttle with that institutional knowledge of space flight in the astronaut corps. Is that something that NASA is losing with you and your shuttle colleagues leaving, or is the agency in a good place that that knowledge is still there?
You have to look towards the future and not get stuck in the past and just say, hey, just because we did it in Apollo or Gemini or Mercury in the shuttle, that's how we have to do it in the future. On the other hand, it's also not wise to throw away knowledge and experience. And that's a tricky bit that we have in our culture, and it's been that way for a long time. Chris Ferguson, great guy, good friend of mine. He really has added a lot to the space program, and he's hit it on the head. And it's not just astronauts, but it's also the flight controllers, the engineers, the folks. I mean, the space shuttle was a miracle of modern technology. It was imperfect, but boy, ask us to try to build something like that today, it would be really hard. The good news is that we have a lot of folks across the country, including in Florida, that can help us with their experience and the new people coming in with their energy. And we can definitely take off from here and really build some amazing things for the future.
In those 30 years, did you ever expect that you were going to run that kind of technological development gamut that you did with the vehicles that you flew in?
No, I didn't think that would, of course, it's a secret. It was my secret hope, right? As an MIT-trained engineer and a graduate from Air Force Test Pilot School, we lived for testing and building created new things and being part of the process. Did not expect that. We thought shuttle was going to last forever until it didn't. But I'm really proud of our teams at SpaceX for the Crew Dragon and Starliner. It's going to get there for the creativity and innovation that got put into it. I got to be a pilot for Crew Dragon, especially meaningful to me because I was on the team to develop Crew Dragon since the very beginning. And some of those user interfaces I had directly pivoted to. It was really special, and I was really glad for the ride.
Is there anything about Dragon you're going to miss?
Our Dragon Endeavor, we had like zero cautions and warnings, no faults. It just it was its sixth flight, and that it did great. Yeah, it's a beautiful spacecraft. Maybe someday I'll get to fly it again. Put it this way, its toilet has not been used a lot, especially for solid applications. So that would be something fun.
Okay, so Mike Fink. Heard it here. Mike Fink wants to number two in a Crew Dragon.
We used to say boldly go.
Boldly go in a Crew Dragon. Yeah. Yeah. I guess you're so quick in those trips, right? You don't really need to use it, right?
Yeah. We were lucky, and the Dragon team at SpaceX are getting more and more confident and smarter and smarter. They know their equipment, the machines, and how it works. And so what's really cool is that we had the earliest launch to docking, which was 14 hours. I shouldn't do it in as early as in like four and a half hours kind of thing. We are, the SpaceX is catching up to that. It's just a matter of getting the experience. And then even our return was rather quick from undocking to a beautiful splashdown near San Diego.
I would be remiss, since you already opened this can of worms, I got to ask you, which vehicle had the best facilities? Soyuz shuttle or Crew Dragon?
I would say Crew Dragon. I
really?
Do not enjoy the space shuttle facilities. I don't think we Americans have mastered the art of toiletry. Although I think SpaceX did a good job. Soyuz is just so trustworthy. It just keeps going.
Yeah, okay, yeah. The shuttle always had some problems with that toilet, didn't it? So.
Yeah, freeze-dried zombie turds. I won't say anything more.
Thank you for that, Mike. Getting a bit serious now, Mike. That last mission did have to come back early because of a medical issue that you had. And I know you spoke about this a lot, but I have to ask you, what do you think was the most valuable lesson that was learned from that? That NASA is putting into place or should put into place for future missions? We're not going away from space. Humans are going to continue to occupy low Earth orbit for a long time. What did they learn from what happened to you?
Yeah, we as humans, especially when we're super busy, we can try to maybe have a tendency to get a little complacent. I'm not saying it was complacent, but it's one of those things. For 25 years of continuous human habitation, we never had a medical failure. We never had to come back home already. And this was the first time. And we really learned a lot from that. And it made us think, all right, how can we do better? Because our equipment, we haven't updated some of things since the early 2010s. It's now 2026. Medical technology is advanced. How can we fix that? Or shall we say, improve that aboard space station? And then, by the way, some of that stuff is pretty cool. Why don't we take it with us on Artemis? This whole thing, I'm really sorry it happened. I know Jared Isaacman told me never to apologize again, but I'm still a little embarrassed that it happened. I'm fine, came home safely, and a great mission. We just missed a couple weeks up there. Chris Williams did a fantastic job in manning the fort, so to speak, and then the rest of Expedition 74 went off great. Now it's Expedition 75. It keeps room and keeps going. And I was glad to have a chance to fly again for sure.
And we were glad to have you back. Yet all eyes on you, making sure you that crew made a safe return home. Finally, Mike, you said you wouldn't mind going back. If you could go anywhere in space, what would your next mission be?
I'm going to answer that in two ways. One is a practical way and one in an ambitious inspirational way, right? So if I had my way, and I would love to walk on them and talking with my management and just seeing how things are going. It was highly unlikely, and I had other opportunities. I'll take a ride to low Earth orbit and do a great job with that. But that's we'll see where any of that goes. I'd say give me a starship, call it Enterprise, call it something like that. We have a whole grand universe out there.
Mike Fink is a retiring NASA astronaut, spent 549 days in space, 3 decades with the agency. Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
Really amazing to be with you.
Still to come, what medical researchers are learning from Fink's medical issue.
So I think this was a textbook example of a case that of course required for the first time in the history of the space station a medical evacuation, but it also showed how prepared we are.
Advances in space medicine, that's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. What happens if you get sick in space? Medical researchers are working to develop new technology and techniques to help when astronauts need medical attention. Right now, to help out when a space traveler feels ill, NASA typically uses telemedicine to help and guides them with diagnostic techniques like giving themselves ultrasounds. But for deep space astronauts bound for the moon or even Mars, access to a doctor may not be that easy. Here to talk more about the advances in space medicine is Dr. Manny Urquieta, the Vice Chair of Aerospace Medicine and Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Central Florida's College of Medicine. Dr. Urquieta, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Brandon.
So, Dr. Urquieta, we're speaking with retiring astronaut Mike Fink, who we know had that medical emergency in space that required bringing him and his crew home early. In hindsight, was that crew ready for a medical emergency on the International Space Station? How did they do?
I think all crews are ready for a medical evacuation. You know, all astronauts, before they go to space, they undergo a very stringent multi-year training process as they are astronaut candidates, and they go through multiple simulations of what could go wrong, both from an environment perspective, but also from a medical perspective. So they're training these type of situations, and luckily enough for the astronauts on the space station, no matter where they are around the Earth, they have access basically 24/7 to Houston Mission Control. So anything that requires feedback from a specialist on Earth, they can just grab the phone and ask for recommendations and why not. So I think this was a textbook example of a case that of course required for the first time in the history of the space station a medical evacuation. But it also showed how prepared we are.
What kind of gear do they have up there to make these medical diagnoses? You mentioned they have access to doctors down here on the ground, but they're going to need some data and observations to even diagnose anything. How are they able to do that on the International Space Station? And how is that changing as we move forward in human space exploration?
The space station has a bunch of luxuries that we're not going to have during the Artemis missions or eventually when we go to Mars. One of them is, as I was mentioning, the fact that they have real-time communications 24/7 with mission control, right? So telemedicine is the first line of defense from any medical emergency or even any situation. The second one is the luxury that every month or so, there's a resupply vehicle that goes to the space station so we can make sure that the pharmacy is, outfitted. Any medical supplies that are expired, we can bring new ones. And that's not something we will have on a mission to the moon or Mars. So from that perspective, even though we have those capabilities, there's still a significant number of limitations from what is available to the astronauts for medical diagnosis. Of course, we don't have things like x-rays, CT scans, MRIs, we don't have lab work capability. So basically, we have to go a little bit back to the basics that we need to come up with a diagnosis. And really the tool that helps us on the space station is the ultrasound, because, ultrasounds are small, they don't produce radiation, and they can be guided from Earth to use them. So from an imaging perspective, ultrasound is the first capability that we have. And how it's changing from ISS to Artemis missions and eventually to Mars is that on ISS, there is someone on Earth guiding how the astronaut is going to acquire the image, right? So they're getting feedback on in real time. For the last several years, we have been now looking at artificial intelligence guidance so that someone who is not a physician and has never grabbed an ultrasound before, with this type of guidance, they would be able to obtain a medical grade image, because those are the things that we will need on missions where time delay communications are going to go up to 40 minutes both ways. So that's the way that at least the ultrasound models are evolving.
That's really interesting, Manny. I never thought of that. Where if I'm on the International Space Station, I'm trying to ultrasound my colleague. You're down there telling me, "Hey, Brendan, go to the left, go to the right, go down." But you're not going to have that when there's 20 minute delay or even less than that. So artificial intelligence is interesting to think about in that aspect. What are some of the medical issues that ultrasound would be able to diagnose? Give me a sense of just the urgency or severity of a medical issue that you'd have to pull out an ultrasound for.
Yeah, ultrasound is actually used as one of the primary imaging modalities for emergencies. And pretty much one of the complexities that we have with traditional ultrasound devices is that you need to change the probe. The probe is basically the gadget that gets connected to the larger device that is actually in contact with the body. And depending how deep or what part of the body you want to image, you need to have a different probe, right? Because some of them are only superficial. Some of them can get a little bit deeper. If you want to take a look at things like blood flow or a type of fluids that are moving, then you need another type of probe. So these new probes that I was mentioning that also have artificial intelligence on them, you have a single probe. So that probe changes electronically. And with a single probe, you can image pretty much the entire part of the body. So that expands the possibility. So things like imaging the abdomen, imaging the heart, imaging the lungs, and pretty much any vessel, even the eyeball, ultrasound can give us these quality images. One of the limitations would be for things inside the skull. For example, ultrasounds are not the best means to image inside the skull, because then you have to go through the bone. So that's not the primary mode. But I would say for a vast majority of medical scenarios that required some type of imaging, ultrasound can give us a good idea of things that could be wrong.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration from Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Dr. Emmanuel Yerketa, the Vice Chair of Aerospace Medicine and Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Central Florida's College of Medicine. Dr. Yerketa, it sounds like this ultrasound machine is super handy in space. You mentioned it's, you know, relatively small, doesn't emit any radiation. Are there any constraints to using it in the microgravity environment?
Training is the biggest constraint that we have, and that's why we have been moving towards smaller models that have AI capabilities enabled. And you know, there's a few limitations from some structures in the body, particularly the skull, that are not ideal for using ultrasounds. But besides that, I think it's a very unique and very nimble capability that I'm sure we will keep bringing to space, regardless of destination, if it's low Earth orbit, moon or Mars. And potentially in the future, once we're looking at permanent habitation on the moon, you know, as NASA and other agencies are planning in the future, then you will have the capability to have more robust medical imaging, diagnosing and testing and the treatment capabilities, particularly for a mission to Mars. If you want to have a permanent habitation there, you will need to bring technology from a medical perspective that will enable. But at least from an exploration perspective, ultrasound, I think, will stay as a primary imaging modality.
Dr. Yerketa, we have spoken on this show quite a bit about how you are gathering more and more data from human spaceflight participants as we are thinking about humans spending more time in space, going to destinations like the moon and Mars, but also more regular, quote unquote, people that are going into space. As this data set gets bigger, what are you learning about the human body and how it adapts to space flight? And what are some of the big things that folks like yourself still need to figure out if we're going to be healthy during these space trips?
On exploration class missions and in the context of going back to the moon and eventually to Mars, I think radiation is one of the biggest challenges, right? Most of the data that we have from human spaceflight has been limited to humans within the Earth's magnetosphere, right? So what this means is that most of the astronauts are still protected from most of the space radiation by the Earth's magnetic fields. Once you go beyond this magnetosphere, when you go to the moon or farther from the moon, then you're really exposed to full space radiation. We call this galactic cosmic radiation. And these are basically very small particles traveling at the speed of light. And they're incredibly difficult to shield from a physical perspective. I would put space radiation as one of the top things to explore, particularly for this type of missions. I think from a radiation perspective, we are relatively fine on missions that will stay on low Earth orbit. And really from a commercial spaceflight perspective, most of these space stations, if not all, will stay within low Earth orbit. So space radiation is not a big concern. For this type of missions, what I particularly find really interesting is the incredible variability between humans in the context of how much bone and muscle mass they lose. In just an example, on the space station, we give pretty much all of the astronauts basically the same exercise requirements, you know, 2 hours of exercise every day. They relatively have the same amount of food, micro, macronutrients, depending on their weight. And still we see a tremendous variability on loss of bone and muscle. In fact, some of the astronauts actually gain muscle and bone in space, where others lose a very significant amount of bone and muscle, where, you know, they both have pretty much, they all have the same food and the same exercise capability. So at this point now, with the new technologies, we can look at what is the genetic, or really the proteins that one person perhaps is producing more than the other one. And now that we have these capabilities to look really at the micro level of each person, I think that's what's going to give us some of the answers, so that we can give to the person that is losing a lot of bone and muscle what the other person that is actually gaining some of these bone muscle in space has. So I think, you know, that the opportunities are really tremendous these days.
So Dr. Yucatta, you're saying that if I want to get that beach physique, I need to go in space and hopefully I have the genetics to build muscle, right? Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, that's about right. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Sounds good. Yeah, all right. I trust you on that one. You know, finally, Dr. Yucatta, you mentioned that you've got a lot of this stuff figured out for low Earth orbit, for those destinations for commercial space stations. But that radiation is going to come into consideration for places like the moon, places like Mars. And I know we just sent a group of people to the moon and back. Are we learning from the Artemis II mission as to what those exposures are? And is that kind of helping you understand what you need to do to protect these future astronauts?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the experiments that I'm quite excited to see the results from the Artemis II mission was the Avatar project. So what they did with that project is that they sent human cells in an organ on a chip. An organ on a chip is basically a little box that has human cells with enough technology to make those cells staying alive during that mission that represent a specific part of the body. So what is very intriguing about this is that they flew those cells to space during that mission, and then they kept pretty much an equivalent of the same cells on Earth. So with that one, you have the capability to compare how these cells that actually went through galactic cosmic radiation on this mission, how did they fare compared to the ones that were still protected, you know, on Earth with the magnetic field. So I am pretty excited to see the results of that one. So absolutely, I think this Artemis II mission is going to bring significant amount of data that will help us to plan future missions.
Dr. Manny Yucatta, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Brandon. Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Manny Yucatta at the University of Central Florida's College of Medicine. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with the show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. If you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. Our email is arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance comes from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.